You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On April 15, 1952, in the Jade Room of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City, there was a launch party for a project involving a collection of books that was purported to encompass all of Western knowledge from Homer to Freud. Alex Beam tells the story of how this collection came to be and of the unlikely pair of academics who led the project in his latest book called A Great Idea at the Time, The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased that it brings Alex Beam to the show today. Hello.
Hey, Leonard. Thank you for having me.
So did you go to the University of Chicago? Is that where this project started?
I didn't attend the University of Chicago because otherwise I'd be a much better educated person than I am, but I have a University of Chicago football hat outside if you want to talk about that. I did practically all of the research for this book in the archives of the University of Chicago, which have the papers of the three legs of the footstool that became the great books of the Western world. That'd be Robert Maynard Hutchins, Mortimer Adler, and William Benton.
What got you thinking about the significance of this collection, what was claimed to contain the greatest books of the Western world?
I guess the egregiousness of the selling proposition initially got me fascinated. I mean, the idea that they would spend 10 years purportedly, to use your word, you know, drawing up a
list. Well, I mispronounced it. At least you pronounced it correctly.
You know, 10 years of time drawing up a list of what they claim to be the 74 greatest works of the Western canon. And then, yeah, with that great kickoff at the Waldorf, that they would sort of commercialize the entire venture. So it kind of passed through a membrane of an intellectual endeavor into a commercial endeavor. And I found that fascinating.
And marketing is a major part of the story, isn't it?
Marketing is a major part of the story. It's a major part of the book I wrote because there's a quote in there, not from me, but they sold them as unabashedly as you sell soap from door to door.
Now, because it was also connected to the Encyclopedia Britannica, wasn't it?
Yes. This kind of business genius, Benton, had purchased the Encyclopedia Britannica for $0 from Sears Roebuck, which understandably found it difficult to sell the encyclopedia through its catalog. And he wanted to get out another line for the Encyclopedia Britannica, so he created this 54-volume set called The Great Books of the Western World, and sort of the same hustlers that went into middle-class homes to sell the encyclopedia sets would at the same time then try to sell the sets of The Great Books of the Western World.
How many books are we talking about?
Well, it was a 5.5-foot wide shelf, so they would try to sell 54 books to the Marks or to the families. They cost in the hundreds of dollars during the late 1950s and 1960s. The price is hard to pin down because they were continually offering kind of suspicious deals.
Leather bound.
So it is said. I mean, it's a pretty cheesy kind of leather when you actually put your hands on it.
But it looks impressive when it's in the bookshelf.
It looks impressive on the bookshelf. And to this day, for quote-unquote intellectuals appearing on cable television, you'll often see the great books arrayed behind them in their offices. And I don't know, I mean, to answer, you know, how many they actually, of course, sold 1 million sets over about a 15-year period.
And you had to buy all 58 books?
Yes, yes. You couldn't opt for just the Greeks.
Is it true that you found a set on eBay?
Well, yes.
How much did you pay?
I think I paid about $185. They're all over eBay. I mean, and I don't mean to be too dismissive, but they're all over eBay because nobody read them. Everybody bought them, nobody read them.
Is that the case with your set? Was it pristine?
Yes. Mint condition, I believe they say in the book trade.
But there are liberal arts curricula that still use these books, aren't there?
Yes. I mean, the great effort to put the great books into the liberal arts curriculum took place at the University of Chicago in the 1930s and 1940s. And ultimately, when Robert Hutchins ceased to be president, the University of Chicago simply walked away from that curriculum. However, two of his guys, Stringfellow Barr, sort of the greatest name in Western letters, and Scott Buchanan, founded wonderful, tiny St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland, which exists to this day. And again, you can go to the internet and punch up their curriculum because it hasn't changed since 1936. So every course for all 4 years is set in stone, and it's the great books of the Western world.
Is it significant that this thing actually came out in 1936, near the end of the Depression? Because to me, this really is a post-World War II phenomenon.
Yes, well, the curriculum went in place in the 1930s, but the great books of the Western world, the book set...
52 on,
is indeed a post-World War II, and there you're exactly right.
It represents this whole new feeling that America is the greatest nation in the world and that we have to catch up with the rest of the world as far as our cultural side is concerned.
Yes, you're exactly right. You're one of the first people to make that point. And, you know, a point I don't make in the book, which is it's a sort of Europeanization of intellectual life.
So many of these books are in translation, in fact.
Right, but we had just, you know, sort of dominated Western Europe, the center of all learning, and now they take the great books, the great works of Western Europe for the main part and start selling them door-to-door in the United States quite successfully. It was a real aspirational moment in American culture, and that's what these guys fed upon.
Let's talk about these guys. Okay, we've already discussed William Benton to some degree, but the two key figures in putting this whole thing together are Robert Hutchins and Mortimer Adler, and they sound like they couldn't have been more unalike than any two people in the world.
Yeah, I sort of fell in love with them both in different ways. Hutchins is the 6 feet 2 inches tall, sort of the Clark Gable of American academics. You know, he became president of the University of Chicago at age 29. He was married to a beautiful sculptress. Everything seemingly came easily to Robert Maynard Hutchins, and his sidekick, the guy he took with him to the University of Chicago to implement both the Great Books curriculum and later to publish the Great Books, was a short guy from Washington Heights in New York City, a scholarship student, a former reporter at the New York Sun, who read the autobiography of John Stuart Mill in the Harvard Classics, owned by his neighbor in Washington Heights. And he was quite successful journalist at age 18. He said, to heck with journalism, I'm going to go into academics. And he won a scholarship to attend Columbia University. That was Mortimer Adler.
But you say he had a talent for putting students to sleep.
Well, I say that only because it's true. Yeah, he was extremely dogmatic. And I mean, you can buy DVDs of Adler teaching high school students who are probably the most soporific young men and women on the planet. You can buy DVDs of his astonishing performances on William F. Buckley's Firing Line.
Astonishing in what way?
Well, they're astonishing period pieces. They're astonishing because he and Buckley just talk essentially about arcane points of Thomistic philosophy in front of stupefied young men and women from high schools and colleges. They're astonishing in that respect.
A lot of showing off.
On both parts. Yeah, I mean, on Adler's part, I'm actually somewhat more forgiving. I only said that he put audiences to sleep because in these famous pranks, he would go once a year to St. John's College, and once each student in the lecture auditorium took an alarm clock with them and had all the alarm clocks go off simultaneously so they could get him to shut up after an hour, which, by the way, did not succeed.
My guest is Alex Beam. His latest book, A Great Idea at the Time, The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books. It's published by Public Affairs. Was the idea for this collection born out of Hutchins' desire to reform the humanities curriculum at Chicago, which, as you say, he arrived from Yale at the age of 30? He must have come with a sense that, since he was so young, that he was going to remake the world.
Yeah, exactly. And I think when you read about this guy, you get this sense of a world about to be discovered. The key, it's very hard to understand Hutchins without understanding his almost fatalistic and sardonic sense of himself. He had been educated at Oberlin, Yale, and Yale Law School, but he famously told Adler that he considered himself completely uneducated, that at Yale he wandered around cutting up frogs, and that at Yale Law School he learned the opinions of some half-literate judges. So he was entranced by the notion of studying only the classics. He had never read these books himself. Adler had read them all at Columbia because Columbia had instituted this fascinating Great Books course. And yeah, I mean, Hutchins went to Chicago He dynamited the entire undergraduate curriculum in 1930, 1931, 1932, and he and Adler themselves started teaching the great books, and it was a radical revolution in how to teach American undergraduates. I mean, a revolution that landed him on the cover of Time magazine, became a huge celebrity phenomenon.
A lot of universities came up with these core curriculum courses, and Columbia had its famous one, but this seems to be more rigid than most. But it also seems to be, when you look over the list, very public domain oriented. These are all books that you don't have to pay royalties on, or most of them.
Yeah, well, they got themselves down a financial rabbit hole. You know, they had originally budgeted publication of the great books of the Western world at $2 million. And then they had this notion that they had to go out and create an index for the books because no one was going to actually read the books, but they wanted to create a kind of trot, if you will, you know, a kind of spark notes, so that people could get all the ideas contained in the books in this ridiculous index called the Syntopicon. And they blew half the budget on the Syntopicon. So yes, I mean, for these truly beautiful works like Don Quixote, like the Iliad and the Odyssey, they were stuck with kind of second-rate 19th-century translations, somewhat poetic, but wildly out of date, especially for the time.
And surprisingly, none of these books are annotated, which would have made more sense than the Synopticon.
Yeah, and that would have cost money, you know. I mean, to buy, for instance, the wonderful Loeb edition of the Shakespeare, which existed. I mean, the thing that blows my mind is one of my favorite books is The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon. Adler was so crazy. He's brilliant and crazy at the same time. He was thinking of publishing Gibbon's work without its footnotes. But first of all, people should go out and read this book because it's funny and beautifully written. And second of all, everyone knows that all the good stuff in Gibbon is in the footnotes. There's gossip there. A lot of his jibes against Christianity are there. I mean, they were a little bit too naive, in my opinion, about this notion that you could come to these sophisticated works cold, you know, without help, without knowledge of when they were written, under what circumstances they were written.
Let's take a little break. When we come back, I want to go over just how the books that were included were chosen. We're talking about 58 volumes, which would seem to be a lot, but actually, when you start writing your own list, you realize that it's not all that much. And since this is also kind of a quirky list, I wonder why some of those ancient Greek philosophers who you knew nobody was going to read were included, and some pretty great writers of more recent vintage were totally excluded. My guest is Alex Beam. He worked at Newsweek and Business Week in the past. At Business Week, he was Boston and Moscow bureau chief. He's also written a twice-weekly column at the Boston Globe since 1987. He's written a couple of novels. And most important, of course, he also writes a weekly blog about squash, the sport, at VanityFair.com. His latest book is A Great Idea at the Time, The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books, published by Public Affairs. Stay with us. We're back with Alex Beam, whose latest book is A Great Idea at the Time, The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books, published by Public Affairs. You don't have to answer this question, but how many of these great books have you read?
I don't mind answering that question. I don't know. I have a variety of I tend to say 16 to 18%, but I mean, I didn't pull a stunt, you know, like claim to have read them, but I think reasonably educated people have read 16 to 18% of these books.
Some of them have read them even without having the collection.
Well, of course. I mean, look, more Americans, I believe, have been to college now than haven't been to college, and a certain percentage of these books are the kinds of books you read in college.
Didn't you attend an adult gathering of Great Books followers? Are there still many of them?
This is an interrogation. Is it true, Mr. Beam, that you attended? Yeah, there's some. The Great Books Foundation, which was founded in the late 1940s, you know, to sort of service the flood tide of great books discussion groups. I was very surprised to find out that they still exist. They're in Chicago. They're not a nonprofit foundation. They exist by selling paperback copies of the great books, sometimes into school curricula. And they still run Great Books Weekends, and I attended two of them. There definitely are Great Books Weekends in the New York City area, and one should approach one's public library, because most American public libraries still have great books reading groups.
But considering all of the criticism in more recent times, you'd think that only a hardcore group of true believers would still be committed to this.
Right. It's important to give credit to the Great Books Foundation, which did not get caught up in this ossified notion that remained at the University of Chicago, that there were only these 54 great books. When you go to a Great Books Weekend now, as I did, you'll typically, like in Chicago, I'm relying on my memory here, but we read Oedipus Rex, then we read Sherwood Anderson, Winesburg, Ohio, which, again, I'm convinced is a lowercase GB great book, certainly a wonderful and thought-provoking book. And then we read The Hummingbird's Daughter, a very contemporary novel out of the American Southwest. So in other words, they get it, the modern purveyors, get it that great books can be synonymous for quality literature.
But only two 20th century writers made the original group, and that's Sigmund Freud and Henry William James?
William James.
Henry James.
I don't actually consider a 20th century writer. But
well, they both lived into the early 20th century.
Right.
Also, interestingly, there was a big debate over whether Dickens and Melville should be included.
Yeah, and Twain and Molière. I mean, I have a whole chapter of, because these guys left the minutes of their discussions, and they're just entertaining in a kind of silly way, because you see how completely random this very august selection process actually is.
So Dickens and Twain didn't make it. Were they seen as too popular?
I guess they were seen as too popular. I mean, I've read those minutes hundreds of times, and I mean, Twain, I think, pulled at the heartstrings of all these people. I think they realized how great he was. And Robert Maynard Hutchins, to his great credit, you'll see from those minutes, was one of the few people who equated pleasure with greatness. And I, speaking for myself, if a great book doesn't give you pleasure, really, and as you know, he insisted on including Tristram Shandy by Laurence Sterne because it made him laugh. And I mean, again, I hope that you and I and everybody listening, if a book doesn't suffuse you with pleasure, well, then is it really a great book?
Well, who were the other members of the committee?
Well, a guy named John Erskine, who in effect invented the great books pedagogy at Columbia. He's the guy who taught Mortimer Adler how to teach the great books. He was out of Columbia University. Joseph Schwab, a famous sort of token scientist. Alexander Michael John, a famous former president of Amherst College. These people were sort of, there were only seven people on the committee, but they were sort of intellectual giants of their time, but to be unfair, no one's ever heard of them now.
I understand that part of the approach when they had to decide on a book was whether it fit within Adler's list of 102 ideas, ideas like aristocracy, chance, cause, form, induction, language, life. Life is a pretty broad thing. I think Twain fits in with life, doesn't he?
I think Twain.
Dickens does too.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't know what induction even means in this regard.
Yeah, no one knows what that means. But that was those 102 ideas, were cobbled together to form this index of ideas, which Benton thought would be sort of the skeleton key to selling the great books. And they, as everyone has since remarked, became sort of a staple for after-dinner speakers. If you had to address a bar association conference and you wanted to quote Plato on justice, well, this was a pretty quick way to do that. And of course, now we have Google for that. So.
But there were other attempts to put together collections of the great works of Western knowledge, and people are still putting together canons these days.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's not a subject the New York Times published the 100 greatest novels of the 20th century. I mean, there's a list mania on one side. Creating a canon I've been told, for instance, Modern Library is going to get back into the business that they used to be in, which was, publishing the great books.
Well, how were Saul Bellow, Gertrude Stein, and Martin Van Doren involved in this story?
Well, Gertrude Stein is the star of one of the funniest anecdotes in my book, because she makes a sort of surprise appearance at a great book seminar accompanied by the Chicago police. Anyway, it's just a very, very funny moment where she ends up hitting Mortimer Adler on the head, swatting him with a rolled up magazine and claiming that he's the young man who's used to getting his way. Mark Van Doren.
Unlike Gertrude Stein, who was an older woman used to getting her way.
Yes. I mean, Alice B. Toklas told Adler when they left that famous Great Books dinner that Gertrude has said so many interesting things here tonight, it will take her 10 years to understand them, which was a real stretch. Adler, of course, retorted that she always said interesting things, but she never ended up understanding them. I don't know. Mark Van Doren, again, I think to many of your listeners, is Christopher Plummer. You know, he was the father of Charles Van Doren in the movie The Quiz Show. He was... this is not an analogy.
He was a Columbia guy.
Yeah, I was going to say he's the Harold Bloom of his generation, but in a way he was kind of better known because he had Life magazine behind him. He was sort of the great litterateur of mid-century, 20th century America, poet, anthologist, and teacher, and a huge proponent of the great books. And you correctly point out that he was on this committee that chose the 54 volumes.
And Saul Bellow, who was a young man at the time living in Chicago.
Yeah, Bellow was a kid. He had been partly educated at Northwestern, partly educated at the University of Chicago, and he was writing what I believe is his first novel called Dangling Man, and for extra money, he was a researcher on the Syntopicon for Mortimer Adler, and he left some wonderful reminiscences.
Dangling
guys.
Man, a really interesting novel, by the way, about a guy who is waiting to go into the military.
Yes. Obviously very topical because it was
written. It wasn't in the Great Book series, but I did read it. when did critics start objecting to the great books of the Western world as something that ignored an awful lot of great writers, women in particular, but also all of the literature of Asia, Africa, and Latin America?
Yeah, you know, I was going to answer the question that I thought you were going to ask before you. I mean, when did critics start objecting to the great books? Of course, that was the minute they were published.
Oh, really? Well, there were always people out there who said, this is not really the list I would have compiled.
Well, no, not for those reasons. Again, as you know, because I know in my book, I mean, basically the New Yorker and the Partisan Review crowd went after the great books, bang, the minute they appeared, partly, I think, on reasons of snobbery, partly on reasons of regional parochialism. These people weren't educated at the University of Chicago. They looked down on Adler. They looked down on what Chicago was doing. But to answer the question that you actually asked, you know, that kind of revulsion at the notion, and you know, these great books that I wrote my book about were all written by dead white males. That kind of revulsion comes into our culture in the late 1970s, I would say, and
as a result of the changes in the 60s. Because someone like Alan Bloom writes The Closing of the American Mind and pretty much revives this debate, doesn't he?
Yes. No, the debate...
The old values are being lost.
Yes, and I believe he was 54 weeks on the bestseller list.
Well, it helps if you're talking about these things to have the last name Bloom, because Harold Bloom and Alan Bloom both have written extensively about the subject.
Yeah, they have. I mean, and to be fair to me, my book is sort of a very I don't really like I'm capable of talking about the canon, but I'm not furiously pro or anti the canon. Alan Bloom is a tricky person because, of course, he comes out of the University of Chicago and he comes out of the conservative pedagogy of the University of Chicago, and his whole reason for being was what I call the shadowy Committee on Social Thought, which was created by Robert Hutchins. So he sprang really full-grown from the intense humanism of the University of Chicago, but for some reason, I think rather cruelly, you know, mocks Mortimer Adler in that best-selling 1987 book. And just he calls Adler a peddler, you know, just a peddler of the great books volumes. But that's very unfair. Bellow, as you also may know, in the novel Ravelstein, the wonderful novel Ravelstein, you know, eulogizes Alan Bloom, I think, rather beautifully. And clearly, Bloom was a person of great refinement who didn't have to dump on people, frankly.
Well, how political was this whole thing?
Well,
because when you make these choices, you're making political choices as well, aren't you?
Yes, that's exactly correct. I mean, when you drop a term like the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago, that's prominently identified basically with right-wing politics, with what's now called Straussian politics. Bloom was a student of Leo Strauss, and I touch upon that in my book, although I'm a little bit impatient with that. People who get behind the great books because of Alan and Harold Bloom are perceived as politically conservative. And as you know, Donald Rumsfeld's wife was on the board of St. John's College. The former president of St. John's College was sent to Iraq disastrously, you know, to become head of the Ministry of Education. I mean, can you imagine a more ill-formed notion, the idea of a proponent of the Western canon being sent to Iraq? So, and, you know, yeah, right-wingers like the great books.
When a book review was published in the New York Times, it elicited a lot more mail than anybody would have expected. Were you surprised?
Yeah, I was surprised, but to be fair, I was pleasantly surprised. It did elicit a lot of mail, and it's been wonderful debate. I'm happy that people care about this subject.
Now, our audience cares about accuracy as well, and they point out that it was Paul Scofield, not Christopher Plummer, who played Mark Van Doren in Quiz Show.
Thank you. I stand corrected. Not for the first time.
We all make those mistakes, but our audience always catches us.
God bless them.
I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Alex Beam's latest book, A Great Idea at the Time, The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books, published by Public Affairs. It's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Leonard, thank you very much.